Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
My guest today is Tim Clydesdale, a professor of sociology at the College of New Jersey, where he conducts research on religion, higher education, and young adults, most notably individuals who are transitioning from high school to college. And he also teaches numerous classes, including, on occasion, a first-year seminar called The Bible, America's Best-Selling Book. Dr. Clydesdale is a graduate of Wheaton College and earned his doctorate at Princeton University. Tim taught at Gordon University prior to moving south to the College of New Jersey. He is the author of two books from the University of Chicago Press, including The First Year Out, Understanding American Teens After High School, and The Purposeful Graduate, Why Colleges Must Talk to Students About Vocation. I should note that I said vocation and not vacation. I know that many of my own students want to talk about their winter and spring breaks and why they need to take the final exam 2 weeks earlier than everybody else in the class, but we are talking about vocation today, not vacation. Tim is currently working on a project entitled The 20-something Soul, Understanding the Religious and Spiritual Lives of American Young Adults, which is being co-authored with Kathleen Garces Foley and Anthony Pogorelk, and is funded by a Lilly Endowment grant to the Life Cycle Institute at the Catholic University of America. Our goal today is to focus on the book The Purposeful Graduate, but I have a feeling that much of our open-ended discussion will entail his other projects as well. You can find links to Professor Clydesdale's biography, his books, and other publications over at our website, so please drop by and say hello. Tim, welcome to Research on Religion.
Thank you, Tony. I'm glad to be here.
It is great to have you here, too, and we're celebrating our 350th anniversary here, and I'd like to thank everybody for listening for this long. You were a listener early on and contacted me, and I said, man, you've got some really interesting stuff here. I want to get you on the show. But I want to start out here with a little bit of biographical information, because you have a rather interesting academic trajectory and some unusual research interests. So I'd like to hear about your own purposeful path, so to speak, as I think it has something to do with the stuff that you end up writing. You attended a private religious college, Wheaton, as an undergraduate. You spent your graduate years at Princeton, and some folks might remember that it does have a seminary attached to it. And then you taught for a spell at Gordon College, which is a religiously based institution in Massachusetts. And now you're at the College of New Jersey, which I think is a public secular school. How did you get from there, meaning Wheaton, to here, meaning the College of New Jersey?
Great question. Thanks, Tony. I would say, you know, Wheaton, I went there from a fundamentalist upbringing. I always tell people I walked the sawdust path on one Sunday in junior church and prayed the sinner's prayer at age five. And that began a journey for me. The folks at my church thought I was heading to a liberal school when I went to Wheaton. And so when I headed out to Wheaton, began there, I went around trying to find a liberal, but was ultimately unsuccessful in that task. But I went there thinking I wanted to be either kind of a pastor or a psychologist some kind of combination thereof. I remember actually as a kid I wrote to Charles Stanley, a TB preacher, and he wrote back and said he had studied psychology and Bible, and so I thought, oh, maybe that's what I'm going to do. And I got in my first psych class, and I was like, oh my goodness, we're studying rats and neurons and synapses, and the only part of it I found interesting was like the last week we discussed social psychology. Of course, that's where sociology and psychology overlapped, and so then I needed to take one more social science, and economics sounded much too challenging, and you know, apologies to you, Tony, but political science didn't sound all that exciting to me either. So I took sociology, not having any idea what it was. I found myself just kind of hooked after the very first class because I said, here's the people. Here's race. Here's social class. Here's social change over time. Here's deviance. I mean, I just found it just really, you know, stunning. Now, throughout my time at Wheaton, I was thinking, you know, still I was going to head to be a minister, but I added in sociology as a second major. And my my faculty mentors there, who were just wonderful and really poured themselves into their students, really encouraged me to pursue sociology as a graduate degree. And I kept saying, no, I'm heading to seminary. But got a job, graduated a semester early, got a job in a local rehabilitation hospital. I was doing institutional research, running numbers, and found that I really did have a true knack for doing research. So that was interesting to me. They then connected me with Robert Wuthnow of Princeton University, who was coming to Wheaton to talk. Robert was, you know, very soft-spoken, kind gentleman who invited me to apply, and I thought, well, you know, I saw that as a sign from God, you know. I should apply if I'm being asked to apply. So I did so, and ended up then being accepted and given a very generous fellowship, and so I went to Princeton and got my doctorate in sociology. So that's how I got to Princeton. Didn't do anything with the seminary other than occasionally use the Princeton Theological Seminary's library, but continued to study religion sociologically, and that became my my focus. That only gets me part of the way there, though, right?
Yeah, before you move on, I have to, there's two interesting things about your bio I didn't know about. First of all, you wrote to a pastor when you were a kid. I mean, I remember a kid growing up, I like would write to Robert Plant of Led Zeppelin, you know, asking for an autograph. You're writing to pastors. So you definitely, you know, walked a better path than I did. And speaking of paths, you said you walked the sawdust path. I think I may have heard that term or phrase a long time ago, but what does that mean? Where did that phrase come from, walk the sawdust path?
Oh, yeah, sawdust path and sawdust trail, and that of course, speaks to the revivalist history in America where people like Charles Finney and whatnot would go around and pop up the tents, and they would lay sawdust down in a field, and they would have these revivals. And so I grew up in kind of the fundamentalist tradition that every service ended with a call to the altar for, you know, to be saved or to be rededicated. And so that's where that phrase come from, the sawdust path. And as for writing to a pastor, yeah, I definitely was in an environment. I mean, I grew up in the city, blue collar, but my parents had me at church every time it was open. In fact, we usually opened the church because my dad was one of the trustees and had the keys. And so we would get there first and open up the church. We were there last and locked up afterwards. So I was in this kind of, fundamentalist bubble kind of growing up very much. So, yeah.
Well, this is interesting. You can tell that you are pumped prime for a vocation. I'm surprised that you didn't consider the seminary at one point in time, but you did the, secular seminary of studying sociology, so to speak, and then we're at Gordon, and you ended up at the College of New Jersey, and we recently had a guest on the show who is married to somebody who's at the College of New Jersey, and I always thought the College of New Jersey was Princeton's old name. And I didn't know very much about this university, or college. Tell us a little bit about it and how you got there.
Yeah, so the College of New Jersey is Princeton's old name, and so they emphasize the in the title. But in fact, Princeton University sued the College of New Jersey, arguing that students might get confused as to which institution they were applying to, and I still remember the judge kind of leaning forward and calling the counsel both sides up and said, listen, if a student gets confused, neither of you want him or her in your institution. So that was the end of that. But so TCNJ, when you're an academic, one of the things you learn early on in grad school is, if you're going to make it as a professor, you got to be willing to go wherever the jobs are. And I ended up marrying when I was at Princeton a townie, a local girl. And so when this position opened up, I mean, it's literally kind of in the center of the bullseye. I'm 6 miles away from the house that she grew up in. And so when that opened up, I was like, you know, I'm gonna head there. And I knew it was a good school. You know, good students. When I got there, the sociology department wasn't in great shape, but it's in wonderful shape now, so it's been a great place to be.
It's a small liberal arts college. It really has a private college feel to it, a vibe to it, and you get to teach these first-year seminars coming in the students, and one of them that you're teaching is an introductory freshman course on the Bible. I mean, when I read that at a public institution in New Jersey, my jaw dropped. What's going on there?
Great question. So our first year seminar program, you know, is probably like many. It's designed to help students think, you know, analytically and do a bit more writing. And the way we kind of shaped it here was it's designed for they want full-time faculty to teach it. They don't want this kind of sent to a bunch of adjuncts. They want full-time faculty teaching it. But they want them to teach on something that is not their primary area of expertise. And so I had a colleague who was a professor of statistics, but he was a Civil War buff, and he created one of these on the Civil War. And so I've not studied the Bible at a graduate level. I had done it as an undergraduate, but thought this would be, a great possibility. And my focus on it is really just exploring together with students genres of biblical text, different paradigms for how one interprets it, and what's been kind of the Bible's influence on American culture, really to understand what the Bible means to those who've made it a bestseller. And there's been some great work done recently. Goff, Farnsley, and Thusen wrote a book with Oxford University called The Bible in American Life. It's a great anthology. We've been reading some things out of that. John Fee wrote The Bible Cause, which is a history of the American Bible Society. So there's some great stuff there, as well as, of course, we look right into the text and have a couple of both a traditionalist and a progressivist kind of introduction to the Bible that we use to kind of help us as we make our way through the text. So it's been a great class. In fact, just yesterday we did our field trip, and we went to Trenton, New Jersey, to Shiloh Baptist Church, Black Baptist Church. Had a great visit there. Students always respond well to that when I've taken them for other classes, and so we get a kind of an inductive approach to the Bible in America.
Very cool. And it sounds as if you're teaching these students a kind of a very well-rounded liberal arts education, which leads us to this issue of vocation, which you're interested in, and your book, The Purposeful Graduate. But before we jump into that book, I want to step back to some of your earlier research, including your book, The First Year Out, Understanding Teens After High School, and some of your other published articles on emerging adults. What can you tell us about the typical 18 to 19-year-old over the past few decades? How have they changed? Or is there a range of these emerging adults that we might encounter in that age group? And the reason I ask is because I have a 17-year-old in the house, and so he's heading into that transitioning period. So I need to know what's going on.
That's a great question. So the term that has now kind of become common among psychologists and sociologists studying this group is emerging adults, and it's those between the ages of 18 and 29. And what's happened over the last half century has been this very gradual, a little bit like, you know, the melting polar cap, but a gradual thing that after you start really noticing it through the years is having a very dramatic effect. And so what happens now is it takes pretty much your entire 20s to attend to the forming of a long-term partnership, to establish a career path, to attain financial independence. All these things are just taking a lot longer to do. Now, 18 to 19-year-olds, of course, are at the front end of that transition. And so what I wrote in The First Year Out was that that time of transition kind of consumes so much of an 18 or a 19-year-old's attention that larger questions of identity, be it gender, race, nationality, or religion, get placed, I say, in a lockbox. and intentionally ignored. The bigger questions, the wider world is intentionally ignored because the pressing business of what I call managing daily life is at the forefront. The good news is that most 18 to 19-year-olds manage to more or less successfully accomplish that transition. I mean, that's the good news. But the cost is at kind of locking away some of the more important issues that can actually help one kind of chart a more meaningful path in life.
You say that the basic task of daily life, I would imagine that this is keeping a bank account and figuring out how to go grocery shopping and when to do the laundry and rent an apartment and that kind of stuff. That's the stuff we're talking about, right?
Yeah, we're talking about those things, and then we're talking about, you know, the other things that they're now in this kind of semi-adult status needing to navigate for themselves on their own, and I call that navigating relationships, both, you know, the existing relationships with their parents and siblings and old friends. They're heading on to college or in any other institutions, the new set of relationships they're finding. So navigating relationships is a huge piece of this. The other one I call is managing gratifications, which admittedly high school students have, you know, ways of kind of sneaking into mom and dad's liquor cabinet from time to time. But there's a point now where, you know, the liquor cabinet isn't locked. They have access to, you know, older, students who will get them whatever they want. And so the question now becomes, how do you manage that, as well as, sexuality, sexual expression. So put all that on the table, right, for them, and that's a lot to manage, in addition to the things you mentioned, like, you know, when do you do your laundry? So you put that all out, and it's kind of like, I don't have time to think about who I am or what it means to be American and so forth, and so those bigger questions get pushed to the side.
And that's where the issue of colleges emphasizing vocation is going to come into play here. One more question on that research about emerging adults, and this kind of touches upon some of the research that you're doing with those folks at the Catholic University of America, is religiosity. There's been a noticeable trend, I think, in Pew data and a few other survey sources that shows these emergent adults, these 20-somethings, are becoming less religious over time. Is that what you're seeing? And do you have an explanation or a gut feeling about what's going on there?
Great question. And where I would actually go is the work I'm doing right now on what will be the third volume on the 20-something soul. But we fielded a national study of some 1,880 20-somethings across the United States. And what we found in that was there's about 33% or so of the population that is really quite devout. And then when we compared that with some general social survey data over time, that devout proportion, about one-third of the population, has been very steady. These are people who attend religious services quite regularly and take their religious lives very important, see it as very important, and spirituality is very important to them. What is changing is the group, as you mentioned, of nuns or people who are religiously unaffiliated. And that's been growing, and we're up at about, in my survey among 20-somethings, it was 29% of the population say they have no religious affiliation. And what's happening is there is a middle category that you can think of as kind of semi-religious, people who have an affiliation, but it's not the most important thing to them. They declare it, but, you know, they might maybe only attend on high holidays, and otherwise it's kind of definitely a very, very back burner thing in their lives. And that's the group where I think we're seeing a number of those folks just kind of say, why are we even doing this anymore? And why do I even claim this affiliation and kind of switching over into the nun category? So the interesting thing about most nuns is that they don't have a religious affiliation, but that doesn't mean they're absent religious beliefs. In fact, I found probably about a third of them are theists. But they, you know, they don't have a particular church or synagogue or temple that they at all feel at home in and name as what they belong to.
One other question too, this comes up too, is that, and this leads us into your book, The Purposeful Graduate, as talking about how colleges train a more well-rounded individual. The stress of getting into college nowadays, it must be one of these additional things that these emerging adults have to wrangle with, especially the 17, 18, 19-year-old. I notice it from my end and my son's friends, just the pressure to get into university nowadays is so much more intense than it was 35 or so years ago when I was negotiating this pathway. Is that having an effect on folks, on our students, much different today than they were, say, 23, 24 years ago when I started teaching at the UW?
I think they are definitely different in with respect to the levels of anxiety and the levels of kind of mental health issues that students are coming in with. 25% of college students are receiving treatment for mental health, and mental health experts estimate that that number could probably be doubled if everyone who needed treatment actually came and got it. So we're at a very high rate of that. I think part of what's going on is this kind of economic anxiety that you know, everyone kind of feels, and young adults in particular are thinking, I've got to figure out a way to make a living at the very point when reaching financial independence is harder and harder. So that becomes, you know, more of a challenge here for them to make sense of. And that leads to greater emphasis on getting into a designer label blue chip school. And so competition for that, you know, 5 to 10% of schools that are highly competitive has gotten more intense, absolutely. What I like to try to remind college students of, though, is that the vast majority of colleges are not that competitive, and they admit over 50% of students that apply to them. So there's getting into college is really not that hard unless you want to get into the absolute elite of the elite, and then that's where the competition is.
Yeah, it's something that I've noticed too and have become quite concerned about, and it does have its impact on the students that end up at many of these universities. And this is in part what your book deals with. It deals with the new emerging adults, the stressors that they have, and then trying to give them some purpose, which is why you titled the book The Purposeful Graduate. You talk about the issue of creating a college career and a professional trajectory and think of it as a vocation. And when I hear the term vocation, it gives me kind of a religious vibe. I tend to think of people who are preparing for the priesthood or the pastorate. We oftentimes use vocation in that idea, but you have a broader idea in mind here. So what do you mean by vocation? Does it entail just chasing after an MBA to get a promotion at work, or what is vocation?
Right. So it does very much have a religious vibe, and that's partly because of the initiative that the grant initiative that I was evaluating for it was driven by an engagement with the theology of vocation. But what I'm defining vocation in when I speak to audiences and write to them in The Purposeful Graduate, I define it as the broadest possible exploration of the ideas of purpose, meaning, and calling, including their religious underpinnings. So for some, that's going to be listening to the voice within. To others, it's going to mean hearing humanity's call to compassion and justice. And to still others, it means devoting one's resources and skills to the service of God and humankind. So I'm talking about a very broad conversation that is open to the religious content, but not necessarily limited to that either.
Now, this is part of a larger project that came out of a Lilly Foundation endowment initiative, and it was a rather well-funded one at the time, some $225 million. That's almost $250 million. That's a lot of cash. What was the intent of this initiative? What did it charge you academics who were part of this project to do, and how did you get linked into the project, and did you get all $225 million?
No, I didn't get all $225 million, to kind of tell the story, I think it's best to kind of tell it historically. It doesn't take long, but basically Eli Lilly was a Union colonel who, after the Civil War, was looking for another means of making money and turned a pharmacist. And he developed a couple techniques that became very successful: gelatin capsules and cherry flavored medicines that compared to the nasty tasting stuff that was being hawked by traveling salespersons at the time was much more appealing. It also worked as it was described. So Lilly Pharmaceuticals has its origins there, And Eli Lilly made a fortune within about 14 years and turned the business over to his sons so he could devote his time to charitable work and serving the deserving poor. His sons continued to navigate the company through some turbulent times in the 1890s and on, and then established the Lilly Endowment to kind of continue their own and their father's interest in charitable work. So the Lilly Endowment is still today, I think, one of the top 10 of the world's largest private endowments, and it has three areas of focus, one of which is funding religion, by which Eli Lilly specifically meant Christianity. So the heads of the religion division wanted to do what they can to facilitate the flourishing of American Christianity or North American Christianity. And they have funded a variety of different projects, but it doesn't take very long in that effort to go from how to nurture American Christianity to how do we get more people to engage with the theology of vocation with the hope that we can continue to supply pulpits and parishes with really good pastors of all sorts. So that was their kind of focus in launching this. They approached me when all the initial five-year grants to some 88 different church-affiliated campuses, religiously affiliated campuses, had already kind of expired, and they were in what they called the renewal phase, which was a $500,000 grant, and each campus had to come up with a matching amount of money to continue the most productive and useful of the work that they had begun. And so they approached me and said, we want to see kind of what the effect of this was nationally. I mean, they were watching it. They were thinking something really, you know, good and beneficial was happening here, but of course that's always the information that's presented to foundation executives. You know, everyone is going to present the best, and they wanted an outside evaluator to kind of come in and take a look at that. So that was my job to come in and to recruit a team of some additional researchers, and we selected some 26 campuses to study in depth of the 88, trying to get a sample of campuses that were known to have very good programs, campuses that had kind of average programs, some campuses that had weaker programs, and then also take a slice of all the different forms of these campuses that there were. There were Roman Catholic campuses, there were evangelical campuses, there were mainline Protestant campuses. There were ethnic campuses, historically black and Hispanic-serving campuses. And then there was a group of campuses that I call virtually unaffiliated campuses, campuses that no longer had any active affiliation with religion but had a religious origin, and they wanted to kind of reconnect with that origin in some way. So those were the campuses that that were involved in this initiative.
So this initiative is trying to develop this vocational training for students, giving them a bigger sense of purpose, listen to the voice within, listen to the voices without, and use their skills for the world. What did some of these programs look like? Again, there's 88 universities, so there's going to be a lot of variety in here, but give us an idea of what the standard program looked like.
Well, that's the thing. There's really no such thing as a standard program, and this is actually, I think, the endowment's wisdom, was that, one, they didn't define vocation. They asked each campus to define vocation using their own tradition and develop programs to creatively engage students in that conversation. And then secondly, they didn't require any specific program. So there was really no typical program, which actually made the task of evaluation a little more challenging. I had originally intended only visit 12 campuses, but then I realized how diverse they were and doubled it and then even added in a couple more after that. So let me briefly describe, you know, three to just give you some sense of the range. One campus, which was a virtually unaffiliated campus, a small campus of about a little over 1,000 students, was no longer actively affiliated with any church. In fact, it took its chapel, removed the steeple, turned it into a black box theater. It had a terrific professor of religion who wrote the grant proposal. And she framed it all around the idea of meaningful work. And at the centerpiece of that initiative was a class that met a religion philosophy requirement, a degree requirement called Work and Meaning. And students could take that class, and it was taught by the professor that wrote it, sat in on the class, brilliant class. It engaged texts as diverse as Barbara Ehrenreich's Nickel and Dimed in America to the Book of Ecclesiastes from the Hebrew Bible. And it really thought deeply and broadly about what is work, what is work about, what makes for meaningful work. And so the students had this, you know, classically rich liberal arts education in this topic. After they completed that class, they were then eligible for a number of additional programs, from stipend and internships and other sorts of service programs, leadership development programs from there. So that was one example. Another campus went a very different route. This was a Roman Catholic campus, Jesuit school, and they decided to create a themed residence hall for sophomore students, which, as I end up in the book saying, that is the best year to kind of focus your efforts on students. And so this program put some 200 sophomores who opted into this residence hall together. They met weekly with staff, faculty, or alumni advisors in small groups, and they would do reflection exercises together and a whole bunch of other things. That had a very powerful effect on those students in thinking broadly and deeply about the world and what it means to be kind of an agent of God, an agent of peace in the world. A third one, very briefly, a historically black college decided, the chaplain there, she knew she could convey the message of vocation, but she couldn't get people into chapel. And so she used the grant, among other things, to hire in a gospel choir director. And that gospel choir became like the region's best gospel choir, racking up all kinds of awards. And she went from about 150 attending chapel services on Sunday on a campus of 1,200 residential students to some 600 showing up because the choir was that good. And then she preached and brought in some guest preachers. And so they did it all through the chapel. So each campus was encouraged to do this in whatever way worked for them, and I think that was actually part of the brilliance and success of the program. Ultimately, that's what they encouraged.
Yeah, the musical one would have absolutely drew me in because I'm a big fan of gospel music and stuff like that. So that's a pretty cool idea. You mentioned that the sophomore year, the second year in college, is the best time to really focus on this vocation. I know we'll talk a little bit about this in your results, but just give us a sense, since you already brought it up, why do you think the sophomore year is the best? If freshmen are just too frantic and just trying to figure out everything, and seniors just don't care anymore, so sophomore is the sweet spot?
So it's interesting. Basically, as I kind of mentioned a few minutes ago during our conversation, the first year is so consumed with kind of daily life management and navigating relationships and managing gratification and larger issues, I said, are intentionally pushed to the side. That's not a good year for doing it. Similarly, senior year is not a good year because I say seniors ride the pendulum between, you know, denial and panic back and forth. I'm not graduating, to I'm not ready, and oh my goodness, what's happening? And so the interesting thing is that sophomore year and junior year are kind of the settled years for a traditional age college student. Things are most settled at that point. They know how to be a college student, but graduation is still, you know, way in the future for them. And it's a point where they tend to kind of relax a little bit more and are willing to engage some of the harder questions. Now, initially, they come up like, oh, I don't know if I want to be a pre-med major anymore. But usually that's just the presenting question, and it's almost kind of like the tip of the proverbial iceberg. Floating below the surface are questions of who is it that I want to become, and what is it that matters to me, and what am I about? And so sophomore year is a time when some students begin to open up kind of naturally to wanting to think about these things. And so it's the pivotal time to engage them on these questions.
Now, let me go ahead and ask a little bit of a cynical question as I was reading your book here. I'm a political economist, a public choice theorist, do a lot of things on bureaucracy, and I'm at a university that has a very large bureaucracy associated with it. And we see these different initiatives and programs come and go, and they usually have these vague-sounding names like Center for Engagement or, you know, Be the Best of You and all these kind of programs. And they... you know, they try to do things, but if you're dropping a huge pile of cash in front of people, it's not surprising that a lot of groups or individuals or faculty members will scramble after this thing to try to get it, and not really connected with what the intent of the foundation might be. They might put a gloss on it, a little bit of a gilded cage that, yeah, that's what we're doing. And then over time, some of these centers tend to devolve into just, you know, it's the center for just keeping our staff employed and the faculty funded and things like this. Was there some concern in the Lilly Foundation about this? And did you kind of, you know, sense some of these programs were just kind of chasing after the money, or were these actually pretty true to form attempts to build vocation?
So the answer to that is yes. It was kind of all those things. Absolutely. But one thing I would say is that all of these institutions were private, and the vast majority of them were not high status. I mean, Duke University was a participant, Boston University was a participant, but most of these campuses were ones that, you know, if you weren't from that immediate region, you probably would have never even heard of them before. One thing that I would say is just kind of during the time of this grant, and then especially to think during the Great Recession, just as these grant projects were expiring, these programs, these campuses have to get down to the bare minimum. There is no room for kind of, you know, funding an office that's just going to basically perpetuate the salaries of the people inside and not actually show something for it. So one of the things that I did after I finished gathering the direct data of interviews and focus groups and observations and the follow-up surveys and things like that, was go back near the end of my writing and look to see and what is still in place. And the remarkable thing I found is that 88% of the campuses continued the programs in some form, 50% of them with really only minimal changes. And the other 38% with some more moderate changes, the sort of changes that would be reasonable, I mean, because they were encouraged to be creative. And when you're creative, you try all kinds of stuff. And when you got a $2 million bank account to draw from, you can try lots of different things. But they pared all that stuff away, and they focused on the things that work. And so I was stunned that 88% of them still had these programs going in some way. In fact, three programs that I had kind of written off as complete disasters managed to resurrect themselves, and two of them got new project directors and did great stuff. Another one, there were antagonists for the program the whole time. It was actually the chapel versus this program, and the chaplain and staff ended up getting dismissed, and then this director of this program got put over in charge of the chapel, and so now suddenly that program even kind of relaunched. So it was amazingly persistent, and let me just add this, the money dried up in 2009. It all had to be spent out by then. But, you know, a follow-up kind of effort, these campuses said, we need to continue this work. We want to go on and approach the Council of Independent Colleges, the CIC, to figure out some way of organizing it. And they formed something called the Network for Vocation and Undergraduate Education. And as of today, they have 217 different colleges or universities across the country that are affiliated with it. And you have to pay dues to be a part of this network. So there is some serious stickiness, I would say, to this idea and some way in which it's working that I would say I've seen bloat, and I'm not a public institution. I've seen some offices that seem to persist, and you wonder why. But in these private institutions where money's tight, I don't see that happening with this, at least.
That's a really cool thing, because one of the things that struck me in your book, in early chapter, you had a figure about the trust of the U.S. population in higher education. And given that I'm in this field, I've been in here for, 23 years employed at a university, and then additional years of going to them. there's been a huge drop in confidence in educational leaders from the, I think you start the chart in the early 1970s, it was around 50% had confidence in educational leaders, and now it's down to 20-25%. It's a pretty steep drop. Thoughts on that?
That's exactly why I titled the book the way I did. I think the reason why there's been this drop is that there's been a decline of attention to who is it that we are producing out the other end of our colleges. Are we producing graduates who, in fact, are marked by the sort of productive skills and the citizenship skills that we say we're supposed to do? So much attention in higher education is put on getting students in, and it's this supply-side model. We assume somehow if we get them onto our campus and they spend 4 years in this intellectually rich environment, they're going to end up out the other end these kind of rich, well-formed citizens. But that's a supply-side model that assumes there's a demand among students for these sorts of enrichment experiences, which I argue largely doesn't exist. What we need to actually do is tap into college students' interests and passions. What is it that they want to do? And then as we facilitate their understanding of that and their thinking through that, that creates in students this sort of passion and energy and hunger that then they take advantage of the rich resources of the university and do end up coming out the other end as citizenship. So I really think that that's why there's been such a decline in so many people's view of higher education. We're not producing the students, except for the few poster, you know, graduates that we put on our alumni magazines. We're not producing those sorts of students in sufficient quantity to justify what we're about. And if we did, we would have that be the number one evidence that we could point to that, in fact, we're doing what we're supposed to be doing.
Yeah, great insights. I'm a big college football fan, so I always watch the college football games, and they have those advertisements for universities. You know, if Alabama is playing Auburn or something, they have these wonderful, you know, ads, and they show these college students just like being brilliant and solving major world problems. And I, you know, go to campus the next day and I go, where are all these students? And it's kind of, there are some absolutely brilliant students there. There's a lot of talented young people out there, but a lot of times they're just walking around going, okay, I'm here. What do I do? What do I do? So let's go ahead and dig into trying to figure out what we do with these students when we get them in here in these different programs. So let's talk about the findings that you have. And you talk about these different programs. And again, there's a wide range of programs that we're dealing with, of, you know, from bringing gospel choirs into a chapel to having dormitories devoted to sophomores, finding vocation, all these different things. We'll talk in generalities. You talk about students and you talk about faculty and staff and the impact it has on them. So let's start off with students. And you talk about different types of students, because the students coming into these programs, what they are at the beginning is going to have an impact on how they interact with it and what comes out the other end. So give us an idea of the typical college students that you see out there.
That's great. Thank you. So what I did, because college students are not all the same, and there's a lot of different typologies that scholars before have created, but the one that I did is I created a 2x3 table and filled it with six different types. And on the two cell side, I put the kind of general approach to education that students have coming in. Are they instrumentalists? Is the primary purpose of higher education to get a better job, which close to 90% of incoming first-year students say at this point? Or is it something broader than that, which I call them idealists, which is admittedly a very expansive definition of idealist, but it's what we've got to work with. So we've got, you know, 90% instrumentalists and 10% idealists. Then the other thing is on the three row side of my 2x3 table, I put concern for grades, whether people have a high concern for grades, a moderate concern for grades, or a low concern for grades. And so that gives you six different types. So, for example, students with a high concern for grades and a very instrumentalist approach, I call the obsessive compulsive achievers. I mean, these are the students who, you know, got a 98 on the quiz, and they're in your office the next day arguing over the 2 points. Mm-hmm. You know, they tend to be very pre-professionally oriented, very driven, but very great driven, intense people who at some level need to stop and learn to breathe a little bit, right? And their counterparts on the idealist side, I call the future intelligentsia, who are the students that, you know, faculty like you and me just kind of love. They're the ones that walk up after a lecture and they want to find out what was the name of that article you cited, and they're telling you about a documentary they watched, and they attend lectures that they don't have to. Basically, they're the next generation of us, the next generation of professors and deans and newspaper editors and whatnot. And we do well kind of keeping our own selves populated, our own type populated, but we haven't typically expanded it. Well, I've got a few other types in there, but the largest group I call utilitarians. These are people with a moderate concern for grades, but a largely instrumentalist approach to education, who, you know, care about grades but don't have a ton of, you know, they're not obsessed about them like others are. And then, again, their counterparts on the idealist side are the reforming, I call them reforming activists, students that are really, really passionate about something, but their passions lie outside of traditional disciplines. They may be passionate about gender issues or race issues or political issues, and very oftenly, they're passionate about religion. And they want to change the world by bringing either a greater racial justice, greater awareness of gender issues, or proselytizing their religion out into the world. Well, what happens with this group is that the idealist types tend to jump onto these programs very quickly because the idea of purpose and meaning and calling very much affirms the way in which these young men and women are passionate about something, be an academic discipline or some societal reform they want to see. That's the core group. And I think we really miss that large group of reforming activists, and that could be a lot bigger group of our, you know, purposeful graduates that we could produce. But the other side, the obsessive compulsive achievers and the utilitarians, often feel just this, I think, this kind of mismatch between the very instrumental outcomes they want to have and the more theoretical sorts of courses that they're taking or that aren't giving them the direct, you know, job skills that they want to have. And so what these students, when they come to these programs, find is a chance to kind of step back a little bit more, to think about why it is they're pursuing the job they are, to think about their values and identify how they want to use them and deploy them in whatever field they're pursuing. And so many of these students found their way into these programs as well and really appreciated the chance to kind of step off of the busy, busy, busy treadmill of kind of everyday life at a university and think a little bit more deeply about why and what they're doing.
Yeah, you mentioned two other types that you didn't mention. Those were the Beeren Circus and Rebels group. And I assume the Beeren Circus crowd is low concern for grades and very instrumentalist. Right.
That's exactly right. Yeah. I call them Beeren Circus, which is a title stolen from Mary Sperver's book with the same title. But these are minimalists, is the other name I give them. They think college is the best four-year party, six-year party often sometimes.
Yeah,
party they've ever been invited to, and they'll do whatever necessary. The cover charge is keeping that 2.0 GPA. By and large, they don't have a whole lot of interest in vocational exploration programs, except some sliver of these students wake up each semester either in jail or in a hospital bed. And as they start thinking about the way they're living and how they need to make some changes, a surprising portion find their way to these programs to reflect on who they are and what they want to really be about. And so I met a handful of folks from this who were former kind of Beeren Circus types there, who found their way to these programs and really used them to kind of rethink and redirect their lives in very productive and positive ways. The last group, the idealist type with minimal concern for grades, are the rebels, folks that are typically out protesting and wanting to bring about change, but they don't tend to last long in most kind of college environments because they don't find them to be very relevant to the issues that matter most. And so I didn't encounter very many of those as I went and did my research, but it does complete the typology.
Yeah, I had to mention the beer and circus crowd because I was kind of that person in school, and I think I kind of found my way to the vocational thing as well. So I want to make sure that those folks are being included. Now, in terms of evaluating these different programs, how'd you go to and figure out, are these programs, these wide variety of programs, really doing what they're doing? What kind of measurements did you have for the outcomes?
Great. Well, because the programs were all so different, I started out qualitatively. We had to kind of go, and we did a lot of observational work. We did a lot of in-depth interviews, focus groups, and telephone interviews. But a big part of what I did was kind of over time, longitudinal study. And so one of the things I did was selected 60 students that were participants in these programs on many of the different campuses, had done an extensive interview with them, about a 90-minute long interview. Pretty much everything that might be relevant about their lives was part of this interview, and as they thought about the future. And then we repeated those interviews more than a year after they had graduated, to kind of see how was any of this making sense as they entered, as students often call it, the real world, and how are they you know, making sense of the real world and making decisions and living their lives in it. And then the other thing I did was went to campuses that were similar to those that had gotten grants but didn't get these grants, and found 65 students there, and I did the same sort of thing. I did interviews when they were seniors at these colleges and universities, and then I re-interviewed them more than a year after they had graduated. And that was one of the most, for me, telling ways in which I saw the difference, was the way in which those that had spent time thinking about these issues when they were in college were much more resilient, because really the story of life after college is a story of setbacks, disappointments, hurdles, things not going the way you had hoped they had gone. And how those that have spent time thinking about purpose, their calling, were much more resilient. They were much more able to handle these sorts of setbacks, to chart another path to get there, whereas those that hadn't spent time were quicker to just kind of abandon course and go in an entirely different direction. And so someone who, say, had studied journalism, and after, you know, 2 months of a job search not working out, ends up taking a job in her father's insurance company, never to look back at journalism again. And so it was really kind of remarkable how those that didn't spend time thinking about this were much more likely to kind of abandon course, and those that did were more likely to have kind of a long-term perspective on life and be more resilient. So that was kind of what I call the kind of home run effect that really convinced me of the impact of it. But I did do some kind of quantitative work. I did compare all 88 of the campuses that had participated in the initiative. I got data from the, it's called IPEDS, which is by the Department of Education, on retention rates, and then got a random sample of campuses that were like this, and found that those campuses that had these grants had overall 25% of them saw an improvement in their graduation retention rates. It was going on these campuses that wasn't happening in the random sample of other campuses that really made quite a difference. So that was another way. I did do some numbers as well to kind of begin to capture a little bit of what the effect was.
Are there any plans to follow some of these students even farther longitudinally, such as once they get into their 30s? Let's see, the program ended in 2009, so we're 8 years out. So many of the students are probably in their early to mid-30s now. If any follow-up to see where they are in their career, maybe in the next 5-10 years?
At this point, no. I had kind of floated some ideas of that sort to the folks at the Lilly Endowment, but they didn't seem to jump at any of those options. And so without some resources to be, I mean, that's a lot of students to kind of track down.
Yeah.
Very hard. And then be able to interview. I would love to do it myself, but unfortunately, that's not likely.
Okay, well, that's appeal to other funders out there. Maybe Templeton or somebody is listening in, and they can throw you a bag of money to do that, because it is a very difficult task, and it'd be interesting to see how this impacts not only them as they move into their 40s, but how they actually manage their kids too, you know, what they emphasize. I think that would be absolutely fascinating. In terms of the student things, one more question in terms of results. Were there any programs or characteristics of programs that seemed to do better than others? Again, we have a wide variety of programs out there. I understand that. But were there certain characteristics or features that stood out that says, yeah, these programs really drew these students in and really had an impact?
There were a few things. One, as I mentioned earlier, those that focused on the sophomore year or the sophomore and the junior year definitely had much more effect than those that tried to work with first-year students or seniors. And it, at some level, it kind of goes against the way a lot of academics think, even the way we do kind of first-year seminars and senior seminars. We think this is the time we're going to do these large, integrative sorts of things, and it's the exact time where, in terms of how these students experience college, they're least ready to kind of really do deep work that way. So those that I think for whatever intuitive reason they said, you know, we really want to prioritize sophomores and juniors, they definitely did better. I also found that, those that found the Goldilocks kind of size was good, right? Not too big, not too small, just right. I mean, if you could have deep and powerful effects on a smaller number of people, but you're not likely to really see that outside of the lives of a few score students. On the other hand, if you tried to go too big and completely transform the entire sophomore class, the entire undergraduate body, that didn't work either. It really helped to kind of focus on a critical mass of, say, 200 to 400 students, and then use that group, you know, energize that group, reach that group well, and then see them kind of spill over and shape others. And then the other, key characteristic is you need to have senior administrative support for this. When the president of the college or university is on board, when the provost is on board, these things tend to really have a powerful effect. If the highest you can get is the associate dean for the liberal arts is kind of the chief supporter of this, it's going to be limited in its effect. The campus has to buy in. The campus leadership has to buy in, which remarkably, a number of them actually did. Some of them changed mission statements that now include the terms vocation or calling and purpose in them, and they've really made this kind of a signature aspect of their campuses. But those are just a few traits that were really important.
Yeah, I the too big size, I mean, I'm at a major public institution that has tens of thousands of undergraduate students, and they always try the freshman book when everybody comes in and, you know, everybody's reading it. The only effect that I've seen is that there's a massive influx of that book into used bookstores around the college campus about 3 weeks later. So, the just right size is really interesting. Now, students are what we always kind of think about as well, but you and I, we're faculty members, and one of the cool things about your study was to see if this had any impact on the faculty. And just like you broke down students into typologies, you broke down faculty members into typologies. And this was somewhat painful reading, because then I started looking for myself in these different quadrants. So tell us about the different faculty at universities, and then how these programs actually impacted some of these different types of faculty.
Great question. So what I would say first is that it wasn't just faculty, it was faculty and staff, because one of the things that I think this program really helped to do is build stronger connections between faculty and staff. I know that I was guilty of this as a faculty member. You think as a faculty member you're the teacher, these are educational institutions, education is the heart of these institutions. So you really see your role as central. And one of the things that I had to eat was a very big piece of humble pie, because I heard over and over and over again from students that I interviewed is that they will always say to me, I learned far more outside of the classroom than I ever learned inside of the classroom. And that's kind of an ouch, you know, because you really think you're doing something, powerful in their lives when you're teaching. And I think there are times we are. But compared to the larger issues and questions of life and things that the students are learning outside, they see that as the most important learning that they're doing. And that's where staff are just as much educators as faculty are. So one of the things this had was a way of actually bringing faculty and staff together a whole lot more. And they began to see each other as educators, because staff can often feel like second-class citizens on many colleges and universities. Now, as far as the college-university environment itself, as an employer, I created what I call a cultural map of this employer, because it's a different context than, say, a for-profit employer. What I did is I intersected two continuums to create this mapping. So the one is a local to cosmopolitan. How much are you oriented in your work to the local, the direct, immediate place that you are, your immediate department and the immediate people that you work with and the students that you serve? And how much are you oriented to a cosmopolitan orientation, to the profession, to the discipline that you're a part of, right? And I think people array themselves along a continuum in their perspective. And then the vertical continuum is basically how your kind of everyday life is kind of structured. And here you can find people who at the top end are hyper busy, who are running around frantically doing all kinds of things and feel like they never have a moment's peace, to folks that at the low end are really in a rut, and they're kind of doing the same thing over and over again and not showing kind of hardly any creativity or broader kind of engagement or variation in what they do. So when you intersect these, you get this cultural field that, to me, is where colleges and universities are as employers. And what you get then in the corners of this graph that I've just created here are four types that people often recognize. So in the corner of in one corner, you've got deadwood, okay, faculty and perhaps staff, although it's a little harder for staff to become deadwood because they can be, fired at will. But faculty can definitely become deadwood. They have a pulse, we know that, but in terms of any vitality, they're not showing any signs, continue to collect a paycheck, but are not really doing anything. And across the diagonal from them are the stars. These are the people who are kind of known far more outside of the institution than they're known inside the institution, these campus stars get a lot of attention, and the deadwood get a lot of attention. There's two other types on the opposite diagonal. I call them the institutional grumblers. So if you go down from the stars, you have the grumblers. These are people who see the grass is always greener somewhere else. They really resent that they're at this particular place. They're very cosmopolitan in their orientation, and so they're kind of in a grumbling state. And then diagonally across from them are the grunts, the people who are really the workhorses of the institution, but are also very much kind of stuck in a very narrow way of thinking about the institution. So what happens on most campuses is those four kind of extreme types are where most people's attention are. And what's neglected are what I call the people in the middle, the good citizens, the folks that are the star teachers, the people who are the public intellectuals, the folks that are the natural mentors, the folks that are the community builders. And because staying in the center of a campus, not being tugged completely to the cosmopolitan side or completely to the local, resisting hyper-busyness but also resisting falling around, is hard. You actually have to work hard to stay in the middle. The force of being at a university or college is something that pulls you to the sides, not keeps you in the middle. And what this initiative did for faculty and staff is they told me over and over again, these questions are as important, the question of calling and purpose and vocation are as important to them as they are to students. They're not something that you settle once and then you're done. They're questions that continue to shape your life for your career throughout your life. As long as you're breathing, and these are questions you should be thinking about, basically. And it also drew more people and renewed the people who were at the center, the good citizens on campus. So it really had a remarkable effect on faculty and staff, given that they were really kind of secondary to the focus of the grant. But in order to get to students, you have to pass through faculty and staff, and it had a good impact on them.
Yeah, it's hard to underemphasize that fact, and I was very enthusiastic to see that it was in your book, because if you have a tired faculty, you're going to get tired students. And to the extent that you can reinvigorate some of these faculty, the students pick up. When you're in a class and you're just going through the motions, they know. But when you're passionate about it, they also pick up as well. Was there some evidence that some of the deadwood or the institutional grunts kind of get pulled more toward the center of good citizenship, or what did you find there?
Well, I mean, I didn't look at that systematically, I would say, but what I did hear from faculty and staff is that many times they just found this was the most exciting work that they had done in like 25 years, and they had some of the most rewarding conversations in 25 years. And so I kind of inferred from those sorts of comments that people had been in other places and were moving more and more to the center. And one of the ways I kind of saw that too was just, you know, I had this survey, and I think it was close to 85-90% of faculty and staff said participation in this program increased their appreciation for the mission of the school. They became more missional in how they thought about the place, which any dean or vice president would pay handily for that. I can't say with any, you know, specific numbers, this many people, you know, moved towards the center, but that was what I had heard kind of anecdotally.
Yeah, I have to admit that this reading your book actually had a bit of a renewal for me too. I think I've traveled through all the different quadrants of that thing, from, you know, star to deadwood to grunt to grumbler. I'm probably most in the grumbler part, which probably have to do a little self-reflection there. But it was kind of nice to think about the mission of doing this. And recently I've been running a reading group with some of my students, and it's not anything I get credit for or get paid for or anything like that, but it is really one of these rewarding things when you get to see students, the light bulb in their head go off and say, oh yeah, this is what this political economy stuff is all about. And that's really, really rewarding and recharges the battery.
It certainly does.
I was going to say, let me go ahead and finish off with a personal reflection of your own, and this might get to the question that you were about to answer there. Has doing this project, talking to these different students, talking to these different faculty, changed the way that you view your own mission in the university and the way that you go about, either pedagogically or administratively? What did you find?
I think it's made a lot of changes over time. It certainly has made me much more attentive to my teaching, I would say, and to my advising and to my work with students. To realize how many students are feeling anxious has been, I think, a very powerful thing for me. To realize how many students, because some of the national data that I cite from the Higher Education Research Institute says 50% of students say a primary reason for coming to college is understand my purpose in life. So there's a lot of students that really want to have this conversation and really want to think about that. And so I've kind of floated more of those things into my classes. And one way it's kind of affected one class in particular is I often teach a senior seminar, which, you know, again, I don't think is the ideal time for all this conversation, as I said, but this is the structure we have. So, you know, in working with the course, I've set that class up now almost as an intervention to kind of teach students about emerging adulthood, the sociology of emerging adulthood, and what's coming ahead, and the need to kind of identify your own kind of purposeful path as you're charting your way through your 20s, to kind of share with them some great texts that kind of help them think a little bit more broadly, but also more concretely about how they can actually begin to bring about some of the changes that they all want to do, but they kind of sometimes struggle with thinking about how to actually do so. So it's definitely changed that as well. It's changed even as how I talk about college to my kids, because one of the things that I've said to them is, you know, it really doesn't matter as much where you attend as much as it matters what you get out of your education. That's the thing that really is going to make the difference. and you want to be at a place where you can, you know, really, you know, pour yourself into what you're doing and find support for the things that you're, you know, most passionate about. And whatever that place is, that's really what matters, not the designer name on the diploma or not.
Amen to that. And for any parents who have students on their way to college, or some students who are on their way to college or in college now, I really have to recommend this book, The Purposeful Graduate: Why Colleges Must Talk to Students About Vocation. It is a fantastic book, and I'm glad that we had you on the show. My guest today has been Tim Clydesdale. Tim, thanks for being on Research on Religion.
And thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.